divorce in the Old Testament, trying to understand what divorce in the Old Testament is. And so we went to the verse that really manages or describes divorce in the Old Testament. That's Deuteronomy chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that if she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hands, and sends her out of his house. And the rest of the verses there says that when she goes to another man, and if he finds some, if he detests her and sends her out of his house, that she can't go back and marry the first man. That's the rule of law under the Old Testament for divorce. There are several other passages that we find that deal with divorce from a standpoint, a practical standpoint, like a high priest could not marry a divorced woman. Most of the priests can't marry a divorced woman. A divorced woman could go back to her father's house if she was a Levite and eat of her eat from her father's portion, the holy portion. We looked at some of those verses earlier on, but this is the verse you have to go to talk about divorce in the Old Testament. And again, we had Jeremiah 3:8 up there, which is where God, where it says, "Then I saw for all the causes which backsliding Israel had committed adultery, and I had put her away and given her a certificate of divorce. Yet her treacherous sister Judah did not fear, but went on and played the harlot also." And so the question I brought up is a little bit, is this a two-part process where you put someone away and hand them a certificate of divorce and put them away? Was it a two-part thing? Under the Old Testament, it's possible that it was. But the reason we're even talking about it in these terms is because a certificate of divorce isn't really seen in the New Testament except when it's talking about the Old Testament. A big deal is made out of that, which we may get to at some point in time, that it needs to be both. For instance, in Malachi chapter 2, it says, "God hates divorce." But if you translate that the right way, it says God hates the putting away. And the question is whether God hates all divorce or whether God hates putting away without a certificate of divorce. And that may sound strange to you, but that actually happens in modern Judaism today, where a man will put his wife away and not give her a certificate of divorce, which means that she can't go and remarry. And what kind of hardship is that to the woman? It can be an extreme hardship. And so some will go to Malachi chapter 2, I think it's in verse 16, and say, that's what God's talking about. I think that's a very narrow view of that particular verse. I think God hates divorce. In the New King James, it says, it translates that God hates divorce. How many of your versions of the Bible say God hates divorce? Mine does. The New King James translators translated that word shalach, which means to send away or to put away, translated that divorce. That's the way I would understand what putting away means. And we're going to get into a word study a little bit later to talk about this, because this is actually something old that's raising its head again, that it has to do with not completing the process and not giving both. I don't believe that it's really a two-part process here. I believe putting away is the divorce, and the certificate is what is the legal aspect of it that gives the woman the right to remarry. We'll get into that a little bit further in a couple of weeks, I think. We showed what a certificate of divorce would look like. Again, this is a translation of one from, I can't remember the date, but it's hundreds, if not thousand years old. And this is very similar to what the Jews use today. It's called a get. And so again, it's very specific, and and now I do release, discharge, and divorce you. The reason for this is that they're severing a legal arrangement, a covenant, and what this is all for. And with this in her hand, a woman dismissed for whatever reason could go and remarry. We saw that divorce in itself is not a sin because God divorced Israel and didn't sin. It's almost impossible for a woman to divorce a man under the law. The divorced party did not sin when they were remarried. We look at that in Deuteronomy 24, that a woman who was put away, and we're going to talk about that today, the reason for that, but a woman who was put away, whether you believe that it was for any cause, whether you believe for fornication, was not penalized as far as being allowed to remarry. Divorce, of course, should never be a first option. Now, again, this is Old Testament stuff, and you wonder sometimes with these two verses. You can go to Ephesians chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. This is where it says in verse 15, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is the law of commandments contained in ordinances. What did Jesus do when he died on the cross? The other verse up here, Colossians 2, 13 and 14, says, having wiped out the handwriting requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he's taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. What did Christ nail to the cross? The law. The law, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, and having wiped out the handwriting requirements was against us. Of course, he's talking to Jews. For the most part here, he's saying that the law is no longer in function. It's the Old Testament for a reason. It's been wiped out, and now there's a New Testament. And so with these two verses, you might ask yourself, why do we care what the Old Testament says about divorce? It's foundational, for sure. And we'll come back to this a little bit. But one of the things we wanted to deal with, when we were looking at this, one of the things I wanted to deal with was this idea of what does it mean? What does the word uncleanness mean? And it seems appropriate that we should understand what uncleanness means. If you go back, and I'm sorry for doing this, to Deuteronomy 24, because I don't think I have it on my slide. He says, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her. That's actually up for quite a bit of debate. In fact, in the time of Jesus, it was up to a big debate. And they came to Jesus in Matthew 19 and says, can you divorce for any cause? And Jesus answers that question. So it'd be good for us to understand what this uncleanness means. In fact, if you go to Matthew 5, 31 and 32, Jesus talks about this very subject. So again, it's good for us to go through here and understand what Jesus means because it's going to affect our study in the long run. So again, Deuteronomy 24, that he has found some uncleanness in her. The text says if she finds no favor in his eyes because she has found some uncleanness in her. Again, at the time of Christ, this was hotly debated. There were two camps or two schools of thought. And you've probably heard this before. The school of Hillel thought that you could divorce for just any cause. In fact, it's quoted in there in Judaism today or the Jewish dictionary or whatever when you're looking at divorce, that they specifically mentioned cooking. You could divorce your wife if she was a bad cook. How many of us would get divorced if their wives were a bad cook? Obviously, my wife is not a bad cook, you know. But the idea that you could divorce your wife for such a trivial cause, the school of Hillel basically says a man should be happy. And if his wife isn't a good cook, he's not going to be happy. And so that's okay. Now, the other school of thought, the school of Shammai, took a much more literal look at this and said, no, it was only for fornication or something that violated the marriage bed. Adultery or immoral behavior. And so you've got these two different schools of thought. You've got what we would call the ultra-liberal and the ultra-conservative. And Jesus actually weighs in on that discussion a little bit. But the word for uncleanness is this Hebrew word irva. And you can look it up if you want. The Strong's number is 06172. It's a Hebrew word. And it means nakedness, nudity, shame, and pudenda. I had to actually look up and see what pudenda means. How many actually know what pudenda means? Do you know what it means?
Yes, sir.
Actually, that's not what it means. pudenda is the exposing of genitalia. specifically, it's usually specifically female genitalia. So that's a very specific understanding of what that word means. So nakedness of a thing, indecency, improper behavior. The C one there is exposed undefended. And if you look at C, that's pretty easy to see when you look at over you look over here at Genesis chapter 42. This is when the brothers come to Joseph, and Joseph is trying to be mean to them. He says, "You've come to spy out the nakedness of the land." What does it mean to spy out the nakedness of the land? It means to find out what its weaknesses are. And so that's what number C, that's a figurative thing. And you see that in a number of cases in the Old Testament where the nakedness of a land is talked about. That's what number C is. But it also really is figurative, but it goes back to the other understanding. You could look at Genesis chapter 9, verse 22. This is where how come my laser's not working? There it goes. Genesis chapter 9, verse 22, where Noah, after he's safely come through the flood waters and stuff, he plants a vineyard. And when he makes wine, he gets drunk on the wine. And it happens that Ham sees him naked in his tent. Now, whether you believe that that's him seeing him naked is just the fact that, oops, I saw my dad naked and went and told my brothers, or you think that something other went on, which we could discuss a little bit more in depth because of what the word means, it could be that you just have seen someone naked. Now, of course, Japheth and Shem actually took a cloak or a blanket and walked backwards into the tent and covered up their father's nakedness so that they wouldn't see their father's nakedness. So that's the same word when they saw his father's nakedness, the nakedness of his father. But the place we find this word most often is in Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20 when it's talking about exposing the nakedness. So let's look at Leviticus 18, verses 6 and 7. And again, it's actually just about every verse in Leviticus 18 uses this word nakedness. "None of you shall approach anyone who is of near kin to him to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord. The nakedness of your father or the nakedness of your mother you shall not uncover. She is your mother. You shall not uncover her nakedness." Now, the idea that I understand here, if it's not the actual act of some kind of sexual act, it is a precursor to a sexual act. That's the intention, is that you're exposing someone's nakedness in order to have sex. The verse in Leviticus 20:11 says, "A man who lies with his father's wife has uncovered his father's nakedness." There you've got two different things. You've got lying with your father's wife and uncovering your father's nakedness. So it'd be my understanding that if it's not the actual act, it's the precursor to the actual act. It's immoral behavior. And you'll see that, and that's why one of the definitions here is indecency or improper behavior. So when a man takes a wife and marries her and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because she has found some uncleanness, I think that's an unfortunate translation of the word. If you look at the 54 uses of the word irva, or its derivatives in the Old Testament, 51 of them are translated nakedness. Two of them are translated uncleanness. And one of them is translated nakedness. It's another form of nakedness. It's nakedness plus something else. So I think it's actually an unfortunate translation by the King James translators or the New King James. They've taken a word and they've clouded its meaning by the way they translated the word. Now, Jews, if they look at this word, they're not looking at it with the word uncleanness. I asked a friend of mine, and she said that ancient Hebrew would have been immoral behavior, and she reads Hebrew. So, but it's my understanding is that this is immoral behavior in a way that is either actual adultery or lasciviousness, or it could be any number of things from. But it's not just seeing someone naked. Did you have a comment, Mike?
I was just in response to the idea that nakedness was a precursor. That's certainly true, but also nakedness is also the symbol of man's sin, as we see in the Garden of Eden, and again in the story of Ham, who is the the one who is the fallen among the three sons, if you will. And what has caused his fallen state is perceiving his father in a naked state, seeing that. And so I think, you know, that to me is part of the root of this whole process of God not liking us.
A counterpoint to that, just briefly, is that when they were, before they ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they were naked and they were not ashamed,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And so sin, the it was the addition of the sin into that that made nakedness shameful. And they saw that they were naked and they were ashamed, and so they sewed themselves garments or aprons of fig leaves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you could talk, actually, you could go back and talk about modesty at that point, right? They sewed themselves aprons. Now, most aprons, what do they cover? The front, right? Most aprons don't cover around the back unless you're really skinny and they wrap around. But the thing is that aprons, how far are aprons? How far do they go down? Usually they just cover it from here to here, right? I think it's the word apron for a reason, but yes. But when God made them garments, He made them tunics, and it covered the top and the bottom, front and back. So tunics usually come down to the knees area. Now robes, on the other hand, go all the way down. The Levites, one of the passages that talks about nakedness, God told the priests to wear trousers. He invented pants. So that when they went up onto the altar, their nakedness was not exposed. So again, now that version of nakedness is really just that. God didn't want their nakedness exposed to people. He didn't want that to be a distraction or whatever. You've got to look at this verse here and kind of decide in your own mind what God is talking about here. Is He talking about sexual behavior, or is He talking about walking in? So if you think about it, if the word is nakedness, I don't even recall if I've ever walked in on someone naked except for my wife accidentally at all. But could you imagine that? A wife is in her tent and is changing or something like that, and someone walks in and sees her naked, and so her husband puts her away for that because someone accidentally saw her naked. Does that make sense to you? Doesn't make as much sense to me, but go ahead, Carl.
What about like locker rooms and gymnasium type situations even back then? I mean, I was in the military. We had open bay showers.
Yep. How comfortable were you with that?
Very uncomfortable. But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I closed my eyes in the shower.
Yeah. Yeah, I hated junior high. For that very reason, right? PE in junior high was an ordeal. The thing, you're exactly right. Gymnasiums, actually, at this time, one of the reasons that they were such a big problem in the time of Christ is because the athletes, they competed naked. And that was really an anathema to the Jews. Now, to the Sanhedrin, or not to the Sadducees, who were more Greek, they were more Grecian in their look, they were more Greek in the way of they looked at things, because they were the high class, upper class. They didn't have as much problem with that, and they wanted to imitate Greek life more than the Pharisees did. And so, yeah, you're right. Gymnasiums were a really big deal, and when they put a gymnasium in Jerusalem, it was a big deal. So let me see where I am in my notes. I'm about to look at the next word. Oops, I saw you naked, or is it a girls gone wild type thing, which again I've never seen, but I understand that they go down to Florida or, you know, places where girls are drinking and they get them to flash themselves on camera or something like that. Is that what we're talking about, or is it actually like the woman who is trying to lure someone in and expose their nakedness in order to basically have sex with someone? There's a range of that this word could mean, and so we have to determine exactly what's going on here. If you look at the Greek word for this, the Greek word would be When the Jews translated the Bible into Greek in the LXX, the Septuagint, they used a specific word, and that word is askemon. It could mean deformed, but in this case, I believe it means indecent or unseemly. And one of the places where you can find that word is in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 20 through 24. Now, indeed, there are many members, yet one body, and the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor can the head to the feet, I have no need of you. No, much rather, those members of the body which seem to be weaker are necessary, and those members of the body which we think to be less honorable, on these we bestow greater honor. And on our unpresentable parts, have greater modesty, but our presentable parts have no need. Unpresentable parts in this case are the parts that we cover up. And what parts is he specifically talking about? Well, this is talking about basically modesty, right? He's saying that you don't go out in public naked. Instead, you cover up your unpresentable parts. That word unpresentable in the New King James and unseemly less presentable, or ASV says uncomely parts. That word is the same word that the Jews used in Deuteronomy chapter 24 when they translated the word irva. So the Jews who translated the LXX understood that to mean nakedness as well, some kind of nakedness. So it's just another place we'd go to. You could look at the nakedness of Noah. How about the nakedness of Bathsheba? When I was teaching Psalm 51, I didn't really get into this aspect of it, but Bathsheba was on her rooftop bathing in the nude, because you don't bathe with clothes on, right? She was bathing in the nude, and David happened to see her. Now, was Bathsheba doing something sinful when she was bathing at night on a rooftop? Linda says no. I don't think she was either. In fact, the reason I don't think she was is because in the whole section of 2 Samuel where Nathan, and 2 Samuel, I think it's 12 and 13, where Nathan comes to him, he says, "You are the man." Did he ever mention Bathsheba in that situation except as being the you that was taken? So Bathsheba, a wealthy woman, went into her rooftop, and it probably was some kind of garden area, went into her rooftop garden area and took a bath at night when there wasn't anyone around. And the only reason David saw her is because his house was taller than hers, most likely. It was in the middle of the night that I don't think that, I personally don't think that Bathsheba was guilty of anything except trying to take a bath. And the Bible would seem to corroborate that by not condemning Bathsheba at all in that situation. Now, I could be wrong, and maybe Bathsheba knew when David got up in the middle of the night and decided to go out there and expose herself to it. But again, the question would be, the Bible doesn't suggest that. Was she, he saw her nakedness, and what happened then? He desired her. He saw her nakedness, and he saw that she was beautiful. Instead of turning away from Bathsheba, David, at that point, he saw her naked. What should he have done? He should have walked back in the house, right? But that's not what he did. And then, so as you at that point, it starts becoming sin. But again, was it that type of nakedness that we're talking about here? I don't think so. Instead, I believe we're speaking of nakedness that surrounds sex. So where would you go in the scripture to see what God meant by the word uncleanness used here? I would suggest that you would go to Matthew chapter 5, verses 31 and 32. I think I have that up here. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you, whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. When Jesus was going out and doing his preaching, and this is from the Sermon on the Mount, and I've got another passage up here that I want to concentrate on in just a second, he had several, you've heard it said, passages. You've heard it said, you're not to hate your enemy, or you're to Well, I don't want to misquote it. But let's see, where am I? How do I do this? Say again. Yeah, love your enemy and hate your neighbor. But I say whoever, I'm sorry, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. But I say whoever hates has already committed murder in his heart is what he says. I'm paraphrasing, right? He talks about lust in the, whoever, you've heard it say, do not commit adultery. But I say whoever lusts in his heart after a woman has already committed adultery in his heart, right? What is Jesus doing in these passages? Is he making new laws? He's clarifying what the law says. What were you going to say, Roger? Yeah. In fact, Jesus makes a point of saying in Matthew 5, 17 through 20, that he didn't come to change the law. He says in verse 17, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy but to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not one jot or tittle will by no means pass away from the law until it's fulfilled." And when was the law fulfilled? On the cross, right? When Jesus sacrificed himself on the cross. That did away with the law. But until then, it wasn't his intention to change the law. So where in the Bible do you go to find what God meant by uncleanness? I think you go to this passage here, or you go to Matthew 19, where Jesus says, or Luke 16, or Mark 10, I believe it is, where someone asked Jesus about this very thing, and he says, except for fornication, well, here he says, except for sexual immorality, or except for fornication, that you can't divorce your wife. So he says, you have heard it said, let's see, it has been said, he didn't say that Moses said that, right? He said, someone saying this. Who was saying it? The school of Hillel was saying it. That you could divorce your wife for any cause. Whoever divorces his wife, let him follow the law, is what he's saying. If you divorce your wife, make sure you give her a certificate of divorce, is what they've been saying. He said, but I say, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and that will, when we go to look at what that word means, except for fornication, you do what? You cause her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. So what did God think that uncleanness, the word unclean, means? Fornication, right? So in this, Lowell, in his series on marriage, divorce, and remarriage, makes a big point of this, and I think it's a valid point, that Moses and Jesus are saying the very same thing. That when Moses gave the law, in Deuteronomy 20, well, God gave the law to Moses. When Moses gave the law in Deuteronomy 24, he meant sexual immorality. He meant not just, oops, I saw you naked. He meant nakedness with intent, or with intent to have sex, or sexual immorality, or in what we would look at in the King James, fornication. I don't think there's any way you can get around looking at it that way. And when Matthew 19, I don't think I have that here yet in my notes. Well, I do mention Matthew 19, but when he comes to in Matthew 19, he says, the Pharisees can come to him and say, can a man put his wife away for just any cause? Can he divorce his wife for just any cause? And Jesus then goes, of course, back to Genesis and says, no, I mean, you're supposed to stay married. And then they come back and say, well, why did Moses give us this command here? And he said, because of the hardness of your hearts. But I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality or except for fornication commits adultery. And so we look at that. And again, I don't mean to belabor the point, except for the fact that we need this to understand what Jesus was talking about and why he was saying what he was saying. And when we look at this, is that God's law has not changed from Moses to Jesus. And really, when we get to it, to Paul. When Paul discusses divorce in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, he says basically, he includes what Jesus says by saying, not I, but the Lord. If a woman separates from her husband or divorces her husband, she shall remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife. That's in verses 10 and 11 of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. He includes this idea of except for sexual immorality, except for fornication, in his talk. So Moses and Jesus and Paul all are agreement in this. And so when we get to Paul, when we're looking at the New Testament, we'll see that this is still only, the only valid reason for divorce. Anyway, any comments or questions on that? I don't see any, so I will go on. Let's see. What do I have here?
Sam,
I have one more. Go ahead.
I think you're showing a good example of how you put a concept together by going to more than just one place.
Mm-hmm.
You want to understand something that Moses said, but Jesus commented on it. I mean, if there's some discrepancy, which there was obviously back at the time of Jesus and those that lived then, then you go see how Jesus spoke about that. He defines what Moses intended. And so that's just one example of a number of times. Sometimes you need to do that when you're trying to figure out what the Bible says as a whole on any subject.
Again, at the time of Jesus, there were two schools of thought, the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai. The school of Hillel said you could divorce for any cause, and when they came to him, they were testing him. It says the Pharisees came and tested him. It's my understanding they wanted to know where he landed on that subject. Some will argue that Jesus did not come down on one side or the other, but I would disagree with that. The fact that he said except for fornication agrees completely with the school of Shammai, the conservative thought on that. If they argue that Jesus wasn't there to answer that question, what they're going to be doing is arguing a different point in that. And we may get to that. I've been studying an additional point on this that really opens up divorce for any cause. And it's not something that I believe that Jesus himself taught. He did. In fact, he taught the opposite of that. Go ahead.
Yeah, the only other, if you take the other conclusion, if you're like the school of Hillel and stuff, that's what somebody thinks today. This is what Moses said, one thing, you know, you can divorce for any cause.
Yep.
And Jesus said that you can't. Well, then in reality, Moses was allowing adultery under Jesus' definition.
Yep.
He was allowing guys to put away their wives when they felt like it, pretty much,
mm-hmm.
and go find another wife, she'd go off and get married. And according to, you know, Romans 7, or according to what we've been looking at, Jesus says that's adultery. So now why would that be, okay, supposedly Moses allowed adultery. That doesn't make sense, right? So you got to be able to put this together, and the only conclusion you really can come up with is that they were saying the same thing.
Right. I've got it in my notes here. So one of the biggest objections to this being adultery or sexual immorality is that a woman could be stoned. A man could be stoned for adultery. In fact, the law is over in Deuteronomy chapter 17. Whoever is deserving of death, if you want to look for your notes, is Deuteronomy 17, 6 and 7, and Deuteronomy 19, 15 and 16. This is not actually on adultery, but it's on the capital punishment. Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. The hands of the witness shall be the first against him to put him to death. Afterwards, the hands of all the people. So when you have a situation like this, was there always proof? The woman who was caught in the very act of adultery, how often do you suppose that happened? It's not as often, right? But what happens if there's evidence of adultery? We see a situation like that, where Joseph thought his wife Mary, or his betrothed Mary, was guilty of fornication, because there was evidence of that. He hadn't known her intimately, but she was pregnant. Of course, she was pregnant with Jesus, who was of the Holy. She was pregnant of the Holy Spirit, and but he saw that and said, "I can't have this marriage. I'm going to put you away." And so he was minded to put her away privately. Could he have had her stoned? There were no witnesses to the fornication. In fact, someone said, "Well, it was your kid," there were no witnesses to the actual. That's why when the woman was brought to Jesus, says caught in the very act, there was more than one witness, apparently, and they wanted to know what Jesus was going to do. Could she have died? Could they have stoned her?
Yes,
they could have. Now, actually, could Jesus have stoned her? Well, no, he wasn't a witness, right? He did not actually witness it. Just a second, Dan. But the point of the matter is that there was a lot of sexual immorality. In fact, there's a test for that in the Old Testament, where a husband thinks his wife has been unfaithful to him, and he could actually take her before the priest. The priest would scrape the ground of the temple and put it in water, of the tabernacle, put it in water and make her drink it. And if her thigh wasted away, that she was guilty. If not, she wasn't guilty. It's called the law of jealousy. But there was, apparently, again, two or three witnesses to put a woman away. So a lot of people are quick to say, well, it couldn't have been adultery. Well, yes, it could have been adultery. It could have been any type of sexual immorality. Dan, did you have a comment?
Yes, that was a Cain group order, and they do it themselves.
Sure.
They brought the woman. Where was the man?
Agreed. I mean, they both should have died.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And that was the biggest indictment against them.
Yeah. 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 But if she were guilty and there were more than two witnesses, yes, she could have been put to death. But Jesus, what did Jesus say to her? He said, go and sin no more. He says, where are your accusers? I do not accuse you either. Go and sin no more. go ahead.
I think it's not could have been put. That was demanded.
Yeah. 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 So, excellent point, of course. Joe?
Yeah, Matthew 5:31, where it says, whoever puts away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery. I guess what I don't, I've read this many times, but I can't even say, if my husband put me away for burning the house,
are you going to remarry? Chances are,
this says that it almost like it's just black and white. That, it causes her to.
I think there's a necessary inference in here.
NIV says victim of adultery, or causes her to be a victim of adultery.
I don't trust the NIV. I think there's a necessary inference here, Joe, is that you're going to get remarried. Especially a woman at this time period is either she's going to go back to her father's house. There are very few Lydias in this time, right, who had their own business and had houses in two different continents and stuff like that. A woman was dependent upon her husband for her livelihood, usually. Very few Proverbs 31 women who had their own business on the side and bought and sold land and stuff like that. Yeah. I think there's a necessary inference there. Yeah. And we're going to pick apart Matthew 5:31 and 32 when we get to it. Did you have a comment, Terry? Okay. She'll wait. I'm not going to pick it apart today, by the way. It'll be later on. But the other place that I like to go to again is, let's see, is this section here. We covered this a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about God marrying Israel. Why did God put away Israel? Why did he give her a certificate of divorce? Because of her adultery. Because someone came in and spied out the nakedness of her land? No, because she was a harlot. She was a bad harlot. She poured out her nakedness. In verse 36 of chapter 16, it says, because your filthiness was poured out and your nakedness was uncovered in your harlotry with your lovers. Again, if you want to understand what God meant by what the word naked meant, I think it's pretty clear. When he divorced Israel, he divorced her because of her harlotry, because of her adultery. Again, Jeremiah 3, Israel committed adultery, I had put her away. I think I've flogged this horse enough, but the whole point of this is that when you're talking about uncleanness in the Old Testament, you're talking about fornication. Go ahead, Ed.
I just wanted to basically interbreed with all the other nations around them. But when it, in the terminology, at least my understanding, it was they were totally given to idols, and that was really instead of being fidelity to Yahweh, right? Instead of being loyal to Jehovah, they were going serving all these idols, and that's basically idolatry, which is adultery.
And I think I can't remember, it's been so long ago since we started this class, but I'm pretty sure that I made a point about that. The thing is that if you, of course, God was not looking at. God is anthropomorphizing Israel as a woman. And that's what Ezekiel 16 is all about. He saw her beauty, and he made a covenant with her. And you're talking about, in that case, you're anthropomorphically talking about a husband and his wife. What better way to illustrate the way Israel was being unfaithful to God through idolatry than to use the relationship of a man and his wife and the wife being unfaithful or being a harlot? And that's exactly, that's the point that God is making. Yes, it is idolatry. Israel committed idolatry. Of course, they also committed fornication, but that's beside the point. Numbers chapter 25, when Balak was trying to tempt Israel, they 1 Corinthians tells us that they sat down to eat and rose up to play. The rose up to play was not soccer. You know, it wasn't whatever their equivalent was in that time frame. It was sexual immorality. And yes, they individually committed fornication with their idols and stuff like that. But the relationship that we see in Ezekiel 16 of a man and his wife, and we see that carried forward in the book of Hosea, a man and his wife, was illustrative of the way that God viewed his relationship with Israel. And anyone who has gone through something like that, I have not, thank goodness, and I think most of us have not, where a spouse has been unfaithful to us, it's devastating emotionally. Because you are just, I mean, you're faithful to that woman, and then to have your spouse or your husband be unfaithful to you, it's not something that you easily recover from. And God wanted the people to understand that's how he felt when Israel was unfaithful to him. But again, good point, Ed. Thanks. Let's move on. Let's move on to the New Testament. understanding what divorce is in the New Testament. We've got a number of passages. I'm missing one up here. And that's Luke chapter 16, if you want to go find it on your own. Divorce in the New Testament is slightly different in that a certificate of divorce is not mentioned except in three passages, and I have those on the board here. Why am I making a point about this particular thing? When it talks about a certificate of divorce in the New Testament, what are we talking about? What Moses commanded. In fact, I bolded that on the Mark 10. And they answered and said, what did Moses command you? When you're looking at Matthew 5, and you're looking at Matthew 19, and you're looking at Luke 16 and Mark 10, what are you looking at? You're looking at Jesus' commentary on the old law, on the law. So when we look at those passages, it's tempting to look at those and say, well, those don't apply to us as Christians. I will tell you that Bill and I are talking to someone who wants to put his wife away for just any cause, we'll go to Matthew 19 and say, you can't do that. You have the only legitimate cause is for fornication. Now, how can we do that? Because really, if you want to be truthful, this is talking about Old Testament law. They come and ask him a question about the law, and Jesus answers their question about the law. But we know the law doesn't apply to us. So how can we bring this into our discussion in the New Testament? 1 Corinthians chapter 7 tells us that. In verse 10, it says, not I, but the Lord, right? Paul's not speaking, but Jesus is speaking. He's telling you what Jesus said. And when he does that, and he's talking about this specific topic of marriage, I believe that we can pull this very passage into the New Testament because Jesus spoke about it, and Paul verified that Jesus spoke about it, and it has something to do with Christians. So why do we put these up here? We put these up here just because we want to benefit from them, but also I believe that, we are bound by them as well. Ed?
Just something good to know, because when I've, I've heard this on like radio shows and things like that, where when somebody has a perspective that they want to fit their situation or fit their mold into the Bible, oh, well, the Bible says this, what they'll do a lot of times, and I've heard, evangelical, TV evangelists and radio evangelists, say, well, that's Pauline doctrine. That's Pauline doctrine. That's not Pauline doctrine. That's, what did Paul say? Not I, but the Lord. This is the Word of God doctrine.
Yeah.
And it's New Testament, and that's what the covenant we're under. It's interesting because people will do that. I've heard people try that.
Right. Under the New Testament, in fact, if you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and we'll look at that as a whole, verse 10 and 11 are specific to Christians. He says, now to the married I command, yet not I but the Lord, that a wife is not to divorce her husband. Let me read it. A wife is not to depart from her husband, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and a husband is not to divorce his wife. Why is a wife to remain unmarried? And you can think of this logically. Why is a wife to remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband? Because if she marries someone else, she's going to commit adultery. It goes, and that's why you bring this passage into the New Testament. Even though Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are in the New Testament, Jesus is specifically talking about the old law here. We're bringing that into the New Testament because Paul brings it in when he's discussing this very verse. Yeah, you're right. It's not Pauline doctrine. In fact, it's to say that it's Pauline or of Peter, that's like saying I am of Apollos, I am of Paul, right? It's divisional. Who wrote the New Testament? The Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit wrote, right? As holy men were moved, right, by the Spirit of God. That's who wrote the New Testament. Are they unified in their doctrine? Absolutely. And so it's not Pauline doctrine. You're making an excellent point, Ed. It's not Pauline doctrine. Let's see. The other point I want to make here is the question is whether or not a bill of divorcement is included or whether we're just looking at the relationship between a man and a woman. The New Testament really doesn't talk about a bill of divorcement except in these verses where he's talking about an Old Testament passage. So when we talk about the process for divorce, there's no theocracy here to give that type. There's no priest or anything to give a bill of divorcement. Some people want to equate the civil divorce with the bill of divorcement. And we're going to make a point later on that that's not the case. That in the New Testament, what is divorce? It is the putting away. It's actually putting away from. And I'm almost out of time. I see. In my notes, I say it's a civil divorce, a paper, a certificate of divorce. And we'll look at the difference between marriage in the eyes of God and the state. That they're two. We looked at the idea that they're two different things, and divorce is the same way. For instance, you can divorce in the eyes of the state, and God will tell you that if you marry someone else, you've committed adultery. Did that certificate of divorce end the marriage? It really didn't. So we're going to look at how we would look at how we would perform a divorce in the eyes of God. And I think it's exactly the opposite of how you would get married in the eyes of God. If you enter into a covenant, you have to break that covenant. And that's a spiritual thing, a spiritual covenant, and the state is not really involved in that per se. And we'll look at that more deeply as we get time. You're raising your hand, Carl.
Yeah. You said a wife is not to depart from her husband.
Yeah.
You said divorce. Where did you get the word divorce on that?
I will tell you that, not next week, but the week after. The word is chorizo. It's the same word that God uses, that Jesus uses in Matthew 19. It says, what God has put together, let not man chorizo. And what is he talking about there? Divorce, right? You could, and we can discuss this point as to whether we're talking about like a legal separation or a separation but he says, let her remain unmarried. Are we talking about, it says, when a wife departs her husband, let her remain unmarried or be divorced or be reconciled. How do you become unmarried? How do you become unmarried?
With a divorce.
With a divorce, right? I think that what we'll find is that chorizo, the Greek word, and I've got it up on my slide in about four slides, is a synonym for divorce. Just like put away is a synonym for divorce. Let's see. Yeah, this is the Hebrew word for put away, and we're basically out of time. But we'll come back and we'll start here when we get. And why am I going back to the Hebrew? Because it's the same. We're going to go there, and then we're going to go to what the Greek word for it is. And I don't like to do word studies for the most part. When the Bible says that Joseph was minded to put away Mary, what was he doing? What was he going to do?
He was going to secretly send her off, basically.
And, he was going to divorce her, Ed, because that's what you do with a betrothed. You have to divorce someone you're betrothed to. Under the Jewish tradition or Jewish law, you were betrothed to someone. She was your wife. You just didn't know her yet because you were you betrothed yourself to her, and then you went out and you created a home and did whatever you could. And then afterwards, you had this wedding reception, and then you took her to your house. But during that time, you were legally married, and he had to actually divorce her. He wanted to divorce her, and that's what put away means. The reason we're going to make this point is, again, because there are those who argue that in order to put away, you have to have a certificate of divorce. And I don't think that's necessarily carries through in the New Testament, but we'll discuss that more when we get time. Next week, unfortunately, I have to be out of town, so Brother Mike is going to be giving the lesson on a topic of his choice. So we'll reconvene in 2 weeks, and then I won't take any more breaks. unless God has other plans for me. So thank you for your time.